Hey guys, it's Albert. We're going to kick things off my five takeaways from week six. Then we got a special guest in to talk the state of quarterbacking in the NFL and in football in general. And as always, we'll wrap things up with the mailbag, all of your questions answered. Let's go. All right, welcome back in. Week six is in the books. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. We got a great guest lined up for this week that I think is going to be of interest to a lot of different fan bases. That's what we're trying to do every week. And so if you want to hear about the state of quarterbacking in the NFL, what might be coming into the NFL the next few years at the position, stay tuned for that. But as always, we're going to kick things off with my five takeaways from the weekend. And my number one takeaway comes from right there on Monday night. The Green Bay Packers wind up beating the Detroit Lions 23-22. And the way it went down, and this is to take nothing away from the Packers, who have played exceptionally well over the first month and a half of the season. They moved to 5-1. They're in first place in the NFC North. It was a travesty, an absolute travesty. And the way it went down, the fact that it was sort of history repeating itself within a half hour, I think half hour real time in that sort of time span, made it worse. And so in case you missed it, just break it down to you. About 9 minutes left, the Lions get a third down stop. They're up 22-13. They're about to force a Green Bay punt. Flag comes out, hands the face call on Trey Flowers. He was going up against the Packers left tackle, David Bakhtiari. Replay showed that Flowers' hand was up in Bakhtiari's shoulder pads and not on his face. Either way, flag's thrown, automatic first down. A few plays later, Aaron Rodgers throws a touchdown pass, cuts the deficit to 22-20. So then the Lions pick up a couple first downs, and they wind up punting. 6 minutes left in the game or so, Packers start driving. They get themselves into field goal range, 1:36 left. The Lions get another third down stop. On this third down, basically the same thing happens. Trey Flowers flagged for hands to the face going up against David Bakhtiari. Replay shows almost the exact same thing, where the officials screwed up once, and from the angle you could see where maybe, you know, you would think there were hands to the face, and then they screw it up again. So you had your warning there, and they screw it up again. If that flag had not been thrown, the Packers are kicking a field goal with 1:36 left to take the lead. Say Mason Crosby hits that. Then Matt Stafford and the Lions offense comes back on the field with 90 seconds left and a chance to win the game. All they got to do is get themselves into field goal range. Instead, the first down puts the Packers in position to put the game away because the Lions at that point burned all of their timeouts to stop the clock in the last series. And so the Packers, very smart play, by the way, I believe it was Jamal Williams, hit the deck inside the five so they could continue to run the clock out. And they run the clock out. Mason Crosby kicks the game winner at the end. So here's where I think this should take us. We need a sky judge. And I can tell you, I polled every head coach in the NFL on this back in March at the league meeting. Overwhelmingly, coaches want a sky judge. I know that there's some feeling, oh, well, you know, is it going to delay the game? Is it going to slow down the game? All we're talking about is putting a full-time official up there and saying your job is to watch all the different angles. And if it's egregious, you can buzz down to the official and say, pick that flag up or throw a flag. And, well, how would you govern this? Well, it's governed by the play clock. So if it's not obvious, you're not going to see it in 40 seconds. If it is obvious, you're going to catch it pretty quickly. You're going to buzz down to the official, and you're going to make the change. If a sky judge is there in this spot, a sky judge looks at the ESPN replay, sees what happens, the official goes and picks up the flag. Simple as that. The Packers are punting with 9 minutes left and failing that inside of 2 minutes. The Packers are kicking the field goal with 1:36 left instead of kicking it with 2 seconds left. And the Lions have a chance to go and win the ball game. And so I know a lot of the coaches felt like the changes that were made last year to pass interference, the pass interference review process, were just a step in the direction of going to a sky judge and getting there in a couple of years. But it feels like we've gone backwards on that. And so now it's going to take ownership involvement, I think. That's where we're gonna, where it's going to have to be. And Jeffrey Lurie, the owner of the Eagles, has been a big, big advocate of the Sky Judge. I think it's going to take people like Lurie to see to it that we're using the technology. Because here's the fact. Here's the root of this for me. My producer, Shelby, sitting on his couch on Sunday, me sitting on my couch on a Sunday. We've got, what, 8, 10, 12 different views in crystal clear, high-definition television of every single play. We've got the benefit of that. And yet, we're not giving the guys who are officiating the game that same benefit. And that's where the disconnect is. All of us at home, all of us watching the games, we have the benefit of all of that. And we're not giving the people who are officiating the game that benefit. Just think about that. How crazy is that? We should give them that benefit. Giving them that benefit means instituting a Sky Judge. Okay, number two. San Francisco 49ers have been fantastic the last 2 weeks and really all year. They are now 5-0. The last two games against two teams, I think, were... Look, if 2 months ago you picked the Browns and the Rams to go to the Super Bowl, I don't think anybody would have sat there and said you're crazy. Those two teams got absolutely punched in the mouth by the San Francisco 49ers the last 2 weeks. The total yardage from those two games, 777 to 337. In NFL terms, that is a bludgeoning. They doubled up both teams in total yardage, and more than that, they beat those teams up. And I don't think it's a fluke. And here's why. Every offseason, we go bananas over the different skill position acquisitions. This year it was like Le'Veon Bell going to the Jets, and that's going to change everything for them. And Odell Beckham going to the Browns, that's going to be a that just shifts the dynamic in the AFC, right? Where are the Browns and the Jets right now? The Browns and the Jets still have offensive line issues. The Browns and the Jets still look like they're a little ways away from being where they need to be as teams. And now look at the Niners. How did they build? How have John Lynch and Kyle Shanahan built that thing? Over their 3 years, their biggest acquisitions, okay? Solomon Thomas, defensive lineman with the third overall pick. Mike McGlinchey, offensive lineman with the ninth overall pick. Nick Bosa, defensive lineman with the second overall pick. Weston Richburg, center, big-time free agent acquisition. D Ford, defensive lineman. They traded for him and gave him a big contract. They fortified the lines of scrimmage. And that's why this is happening. I think a lot of people out there couldn't name the receivers who are playing for the Niners right now. You probably know George Kittle, but you might not know Dante Pettis. You might not know Deebo Samuel. You might not know Marquise Goodwin. You might not know those guys. And that's sort of by design. They have put their eggs in the basket of building through the lines of scrimmage. And if you go back and you look at the teams that were alive at the end last year, the four teams that were alive at the end, the Rams, the Saints, the Chiefs, and the Patriots, all four of those teams were heavily invested in the lines of scrimmage. That's how you win in the NFL. And that's why I think the Niners are for real. All right, number three, the Cowboys' issues going into what's going to be a positively enormous game against the Philadelphia Eagles on Sunday. After a fast, impressive 3-0 start, when they looked like one of the three or four most complete teams in football, Cowboys have now lost three in a row, and Sunday was different. I mean, you look at their previous losses, and they lose to the Saints. That's a really good Saints team, even without Drew Brees. They lose to the Packers. Okay, Aaron Rodgers played really well in that game. But losing to the Jets, I think, sort of puts a different spin on where they are as a team right now. And maybe as a team in crisis. And so now they go to Philadelphia. Now Philadelphia comes in on Sunday night. Both teams are 3-3. Both teams are spinning their wheels a little bit. So why are the Cowboys here? With the Eagles, it's easy to pinpoint some of the issues, right? The Eagles, they've got the problem at corner. They've had some injury issues. The Cowboys have had the tackle injury issue. But they still... It still looks like the roster still looks like it should be one of the more complete rosters. So, kind of did some digging, turned over some rocks, and what I found, There are inconsistencies in the way that they've executed on a down-to-down basis. There are inconsistencies in the way guys are playing and kind of trying to go outside their roles and doing a little too much. And it's sort of one of those things where it's like drip, 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 and all of a sudden you're taking on water. And how do you get yourself out of that? And that's why I think Jason Garrett remains the most important person in that building. Now, they do have problems on the field. The corners haven't been as good as they would have expected them to be. Obviously, you know, getting Lyle Collins and Tyron Smith back will help. But it's going to be on the coaches to find a way to get that team back where it needs to be, just from an execution standpoint. Because the reason, and I know it's boring, but like discipline and playing within yourself and playing within what you're being asked to do, like that's why they've gotten off to the rough starts against the Jets and the Packers the last couple of weeks. That's why the Saints game I turned into such a rock fight. It's going to be on the coaches to find a way to tighten up the operation. And with Jason Garrett in a contract year, it's obvious that if they can't do that, then everyone's going to be gone and we're going to be sitting in December talking about whether or not the Cowboys can lure Lincoln Riley from Oklahoma. Okay, number four, and this is from Shelby because I always ask my producer Shelby what he wants to hear about Kirk Cousins. Is he for real? Is what we saw on Sunday for real? And I will tell you this, that I think with Kirk Cousins is like a lot of other quarterbacks. When things are right around him, he's really good. Okay? What was right around him on Sunday? You had a locked-in Stephon Diggs. You had Adam Thielen doing his job as usual. You had an offensive line that was getting the job done against the Philadelphia pass rush. You had matchups. Again, Diggs and Thielen against that Philadelphia secondary. You know, that's something that you can kind of focus in on if you're the Vikings and take apart. And so I think what we saw on Sunday was sort of who Kirk Cousins is, which is he's a rhythm quarterback. And if you can keep him playing on schedule and he's not forced to go off script, he can be really good. And if you're really good around him, he's just fine. And I still think the Vikings, who were my Super Bowl pick last year, and I've lost a little faith in them, but they were just my Super Bowl pick last year. The Vikings, I think, are still capable of making a deep playoff run if everything's right around Kirk Cousins. That's going to mean staying healthy on offense. That's going to mean continuing to have Diggs locked in. And that's going to mean continuing to play the way that they've played on defense. Finally, number five, and this might be like the most interesting team to me, and I know they're not playing this week, but I want to mention them because I think the coaching staff there has done a really good job. That's the Carolina Panthers. They've won 4 in a row now. They're 4-0 without Cam Newton, which matches what the Saints have been able to do without Drew Brees. So Ron Rivera has done a nice job the same way Sean Payton's done a nice job in New Orleans, and I think both these teams benefit from having had to go through this and could benefit in December and January for having had to go through this. And so the Panthers situation is fascinating because, you know, what I was told, I texted with Ron Rivera after the game on Sunday, and I've talked to other people there too, they are not making any final decision on quarterback now. They're going to take it week to week. They're going to get Cam back to 100%, and then they're going to make a call. And to me, not saying definitively Cam's our starter when he gets back is an interesting twist on all of this because there's a decision point coming on Cam Newton after the year. In 2020, his contract is in its final year. That's a natural decision point for the franchise. So what do they do? Do they go with Kyle Allen the rest of the year because he's the hot hand? Because if you do that, the decision, I think, to some degree is made for you. Do you go back to Cam Newton with a short leash and say, if you don't perform better than Kyle Allen did, then we're going to have to go back to him? Or do you go back to Cam Newton full bore and say, we're invested in you, we're going forward with you, which would allow you actually as a franchise to make a more informed decision in the spring of 2020. It's a fascinating dynamic there, especially because, you know, look, Ron Rivera and that staff, they need to do a good job to make sure they're still there in 2020. And so there are lots of moving parts there. And I think Ron Rivera is one of the best in the NFL at being able to navigate these sorts of things. So really, really interesting situation there in Carolina. And with that, for more talk about the quarterback position, We're going to bring in our guest right after this. All right, now we're going to welcome in a guest who, quite honestly, I've leaned on a bunch over the last few years because he knows quarterbacks so well, not just from watching them, but also just from his own personal knowledge and work with a lot of these guys. He gets a lot of the quarterbacks when they're high schoolers, works with some of the best quarterbacks in the country while they're in high school, trains them while they're in college, gets them ready for the draft, and keeps working with them in the pros. And that's ex-NFL quarterback Jordan Palmer. Jordan, what's up?
Thanks for having me, man.
You got
it's
it.
Always good to rap.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start here. One of the reasons I want to bring you in is to talk about quarterback development. And really it sort of hit me this week because you saw what happened with Jameis Winston in London, the 5-interception game, and it kind of goes back to a lot of the problems he's had going back to Florida State. And then Marcus Mariota getting benched for Ryan Tannehill in Tennessee. And so, yeah, I want to start there with you, just kind of what it says to you about how these guys have been developed, what it says to you about where each of these guys are, and maybe what it says to you about the way NFL is bringing quarterbacks up to see, two guys who were drafted 1-2 less than 5 years ago having this happen on the same weekend.
Yeah, it's a little serendipitous, because I can remember being at the Rose Bowl when they played against each other. I think it was the first round of the playoffs in college football. I don't know specifically what it was, but I just remember going to LA and watching the Jameis Marcus game. And then for this to kind of not culminate, because I don't think this is the end, but for it to happen and things to transpire this way. I spent a lot of time talking about quarterback development, whether that's talking to younger players, as you mentioned, I work with a lot of guys all ages, or in, post-mortem, what happened in conversations like this. And so much of the development of these quarterbacks has to do with the development. People always talk about quarterback development, and then they go back to arm strength and talent and size and speed. And it's like, whoa, let's break down the word development for a second, because I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that Marcus Mariota's had 4 different people calling plays in 5 years, and Jameis has had 3. And 3 or 4 head coaches. And so this is the most complex position in sports. It's the most complex sport. And, it's also the most scrutinized position. And so much of these conversations really come from the players not living up to the potential that other people have set out for them. And there's just a lot of moving parts and a lot of pieces. And one of the biggest ones being, how's this offense being installed? Who's actually calling the plays? And a lot of that contributes to the net result of the opinions that we form on these guys. And those are just 2 more players that have had a lot of different people telling them what to do. And unfortunately, they're kind of on the wrong end of that. And I'm not saying that there's no blame on the players when they don't play well, but I think you really got to look at how these guys are being developed and kind of measure that against the people that we'd say 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years in have done a great job. And if you're going to compare the players to those guys, then you got to compare their situations as well. And there's 2 players right there that had less than ideal development phases.
So how much of it would you say is like, when you look at a quarterback 5, 6, 7 years in the pros, how much of it would you say is the player and what he is, and how much of it is the environment that he's placed into?
Well, I don't even know if you can say that it's this percentage one and this percentage the other, but I mean, they're damn near 50-50. I mean, that's a hard one to break down. I wish this was a science and we could say, just check these 3 boxes and you'll have yourself a franchise guy. But it's certainly not 90%, 10%. The player, let's kind of break them down. So in terms of a player, at least this is where my eye goes early on in evaluating talent. And I by no means am better than the guy next to me. But I have a different vantage point, and I have exposure. As you mentioned earlier, some of these guys have been around since high school. I met Mahomes his sophomore year in college. Deshaun Watson was going into his senior year in high school. Sam Darnold I met when he was 15. So I've got a different vantage point and perspective on this. I also have the perspective of my brother, who was the number one pick, Heisman Trophy winner, one of the highest paid players in the history of the game. And I was a sixth round pick that got cut that only had one offer. So I've got a unique perspective from the guy. I had to claw my way in and got cut a million times, and Carson had a best case scenario. And so all of that at least has led me to believe this, that my eye goes first when evaluating a player to, do they have a pattern of dealing with adversity well? And that may shock some people and say, no, it's about arm strength. Well, I just disagree, because this position at this level is so difficult, and there's so much more adversity than there is success. The success is celebrated, and so fans and people think, oh, this guy won a Super Bowl, this guy, you know, was picked high, or this guy signed a new contract, that there's all this success. But the time spent, I think more time is spent dealing with adversity than dealing with success. And so my eye first goes, when I'm evaluating talent, to, does this guy have a pattern of dealing with it well, of handling adversity well? So some of the names I just mentioned, you look at Deshaun Watson, look at his upbringing. That's well documented. Mm-hmm. He handled it so well. And I'm not talking about he was a nice kid and smiled through it. I'm talking about it. He excelled in the classroom. He excelled on the field, on the court, in the community, amidst chaos as a child. And so as you get older and you deal with more adversity, it becomes easier and easier. Well, the throwing the football and the reading the defenses, that's all learnable to some extent. So on the player, that's the first place my eye goes to. The second thing is the moment. How do they handle the moments? And that's not just they don't have to play in a national championship to prove that they can handle the moment. It may be they sat for forever, and then when they were finally given an opportunity, Gardner Minshew at Washington State, they took it and ran with it, and it wasn't too big for them. Because when guys have a pattern of that, then all of a sudden you go, okay, well, the NFL's lights won't be too bright. Make sense?
Yep. Yeah, no, absolutely.
So, like, those are the first two things I go to.
So, like the guys you've worked with then, who really – and I know you probably feel strongly about a lot of different guys for different reasons. Are there a couple guys that you really felt strongly, like, check those boxes after you worked with them and sent them off to the NFL?
I mean, the majority of the guys that I've worked with, I would say. Because, again, this is the first place my eye goes. I'm looking for these guys. I'm not everybody getting ready for the draft wants to train with me. They have other guys or whatever. So this is by no means I'm picking the people that I want. But of the guys that do want to train with me, they're all guys that I really wanted to work with that player. So these are things that I've seen. Kyle Allen's a perfect example. I watched him handle big moments in high school, big moments in college. You know, he didn't get invited to the combine. This sounds stupid, but he didn't get invited to the combine. And he only had one coach from a team show up to his pro day. And that was the main team that we were trying to just build a relationship and get him in front of and all of that there. And he knew this was the only chance you're going to have to perform in front of any teams. Nobody's really going to watch this tape of your pro day, right?
Right.
And that was Scott Turner, the quarterback coach of the Carolina Panthers.
And so that relationship.
And he had an unbelievable pro day. Like that moment, sure, it's a pro day, it's routes on air. I don't care. It could have gone great. It could have gone okay. Or it could have gone terrible. And it went perfect. So he handled those individual moments, right? So then he starts the last game of the season last year. You know, he's on practice squad, gets cut, comes back, starts at New Orleans, last game of the season. I don't care if a couple starters were sitting or not, balled out. So I was not surprised the way that things have been going this year for him at all. And I won't be surprised. This is a playoff team. I'll say it right now. I won't be surprised at all if he plays really well all the way through the playoffs, because he just has a pattern of dealing with adversity well and of handling the moment well. And he's got to work on the other stuff. But if you have those two things, you got a shot. And there's a bunch of guys, Gardner Minshew is another example, that are just handling those two things well, and they're putting themselves in a position to have success.
So it's almost like you look at those as like, those are prereqs. That's not even stuff you'd like to see. That's stuff you have to have.
Yeah, I call them foundational elements. It's part of the foundation. Confidence is another. It's part of the foundation. Notice we haven't talked about height yet. Notice we haven't talked about 40 time or arm strength yet. I just think they're secondary elements. They're not foundational. They're structural elements. If you look at building a house, this is the foundation. This is the concrete in the ground that you have to have. You still got to build the sides and, you know what I mean, and get some 2.5x4s up and frame it and all that. Those are structural elements. Like, those are really important too, but they're not foundational.
Well, that's interesting too, because I feel like on Sunday we saw that with Deshaun, where I don't know how much of the game you saw, but like at the end of the game, it's 4th and 3. like very easily, you know, Bill O'Brien could have kicked a field goal there. He could have pooch punted, and he decides to go for it. He puts the ball in Deshaun's hands, and Deshaun makes an adjustment, completes the pass, and it's over. And the game's over. They've gone into Arrowhead. They've won. They beat the Chiefs, who I think a lot of people felt like coming into the year might be the team that winds up winning the Super Bowl. And so, like, it feels to me like that's sort of what you're talking about. That's like one of those moments. Deshaun was completely calm and cool in that moment. No problem at all. Same kid that won the national championship at Clemson.
Yeah, the moment has never been an issue for him. And so Deshaun's a very interesting case study. He's unique in this because his childhood was he was dealt with so much adversity in his childhood and had to become the man of the house and a lot of things. It's all well documented, right? This isn't like private information.
Yep.
But because of those things, with the moment to him, and we've talked about this, the moment, the big moment, you know, against Bama, right? Unbeatable Bama. There's no way you guys can compete with them kind of thing at that time. And then, you know, the way he handled those moments, they're just fun. It's not seen as adversity. You think Bama's defense is, you know, I remember that the second national championship because he went off in both games.
Yeah.
Right. The second one, though, I don't remember a quarterback getting hit that often and that hard in a game. That game just jumps out to me. But that's not, it doesn't register with him as adversity, Bama's defense and this guy and that player and this coordinator. That's just fun and an opportunity to win. And he's so competitive that. That's why he just always plays well. And this is less documented, but his first road game in the NFL was at New England, week 3. And he went off and he drove down the field with barely any time left and they won the game. And then their defense gave up a 1:20 drive for a touchdown through a corner out to Brandon Cooks to lose the game. His next road game at Seattle, he goes off, drives down, wins the game, except the defense gave up another 1.5-minute touchdown drive and Russell Wilson beat. He essentially, his first two giant moment games, Tom Brady, Russell Wilson at Foxborough, at the Link or whatever, Seattle.
Yep.
And he went off in those, like the moment has just never registered to him as this insurmountable moment in time. It's just this awesome opportunity to be the man and be the best guy on the field. So Bill O'Brien's smart to 100% of the time put the ball in his hands at the end of the game. 100 out of 100 times. I don't care if Fairbairn's the best kicker in the league. Let him win that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because it kind of like, and I don't think many people would compare Deshaun to Brady, but like, I sort of think of Brady as the same thing, adversity in a different way, but he did deal with adversity, right? You know, with everything that happened at Michigan and then being drafted in the 6th round, and he's handled the moments in an incredible off the charts way. So
yeah, here's the other thing too. And I work with a lot of these guys who I could say this is pretty true of a couple of guys. Deshaun's one of them though. So Deshaun wants to be the greatest football player in the history of the world, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's something he'd ever talk about, but internally that's what he thinks. And so you can sit here and you can go, well, you know, you can compare this and can compare that. I would say he's ahead of schedule. If Brady's the best, Brady never won any high school championships. Deshaun won 3. He never won any college championships. Deshaun won 1 and almost won 2. Like, you know what I mean? Like, these guys are looking at themselves a little different. They're going, wait a second, I'm ahead of pace.
Yeah.
Deshaun Stratton needs to win 1 this year. He's not sitting here going, boy, I hope I have a great year. He's going, dude, I'm trying to be the best ever. I got to win 7 now. I need to win 1 this year.
Right.
That's why it was so devastating his rookie year when he got hurt. They thought they had a Super Bowl team. That was what he was upset about. Like, last year, you know, like, they just didn't have the pieces and whatever. Like, that's frustrating. This year, no, they're trying to win the Super Bowl.
Right.
Don't think for a second that he's trying to have a good year and give it his best. These guys all are. Sam Darnold, they're all like, they're chasing Brady. Brady's their dad's age. They grew up watching Brady. They were fans of him 3, 4, 5 years ago, but they are absolutely trying to steal his lunch.
So do you see the same thing from Sam on Sunday then? Because I know obviously
100%.
You've worked closely with him. He deals with the mono thing, which is just like a weird thing to deal with, I guess, when you're in your second year in the NFL. But he comes back against the Cowboys. It's, you know, the national game of the week. It's, I mean, like you know, Nance and Romo on that game. He knows everybody's watching. It's against America's team. And after not having played for a month, like looks like he never came out of the lineup.
I think Sunday was one of the most impressive, just knowing what Sam went through this last month.
Yeah.
One of the most impressive performances I've seen, and as locked in as I've ever seen him. Now, I can speak to Sam on the moment, too. Again, he kind of grew up in my backyard and known him since he was a kid and had zits all over his face, you know, and braces. but I go back to USC. He thought he was the best player between him and Max Brown, his redshirt freshman year. Little political deal. They had to start Max Brown because they didn't have a backup. Max would have transferred, graduate transfer. They'd have been starting off against Bama with a redshirt freshman and a walk-on backup. So he didn't get the starting nod. Week three, he does. And he just went off. They lost to Utah, and then they didn't lose again, nine straight. And then the Rose Bowl versus Penn State. And so the moment was always an opportunity, and he never saw it the way that normal humans see big, tiny, big, huge moments. He just never, it never registered to him that way. And then, you know, he showed that, and he showed, you know, the pick six to start off his rookie year and then to come back and lead a drive, right? Like these individual moments that are impressive. But what was so impressive about Sunday was missing a month. He's not the first guy to miss a month, right? He's not the first guy to be hurt or be sick or any of those things. But to have the hype and the expectations, and I don't think hype really matters to him, but to have the expectations that they had coming into this year, and then to not, you know, to blow a 16-point lead versus, you know, Josh Allen and the Bills at home, week one, I was at that game. And then to have mono, you know, mono to some extent is a self-inflicted thing. So it sucks. You're out. You feel like you're letting all these people down. And it feels a little self-inflicted, right?
Yeah.
It's not that he got rolled up from behind on his ankle, right? Mm-hmm. It was uncontrollable. It's a little bit like had he got hurt playing basketball. You know what I mean? Like it was a little self-inflicted. So there's a lot of emotions. I'm not speaking for him. I'm just evaluating from the outsider's perspective of frustration and letting people down and guilt. And then you watch this team just get dumped on and unravel, right? Like historically bad offense and this, and Simeon gets hurt and the coaching staff's under siege. And to be able to compartmentalize, lock in, come back and just do his job. That's what he did on Sunday. He just executed the game plan perfectly. One of the best games he's ever played. Yeah, he had a couple unbelievable throws, but he just did his job, stayed disciplined, stayed locked in. And, man, New York City, Cowboys in town, first game back, Nance and Rowe. There's a lot of good reasons to come unraveled and not play within yourself and reach and try to do too much. And he just didn't from the first snap to the last snap. And that's as impressive as the 92-yard touchdown pass. The fans think that's an impressive throw. No, that's an impressive mentality to me. To be able at 22, to be able to lock in like that, man, if you can do that, that's handling adversity really well. The next time adversity hits, it's not going to be as hard as that. And he's going to have a lot of confidence stepping into those moments.
That's unteachable, right?
I don't think it's teachable because I create a lot of drills for guys.
Yeah.
I can't manufacture adversity, right? Yeah. I'm not going to hurt anybody's family member. I'm not going to create any drama. I'm not going to tackle anybody in a drill, right? So I can't manufacture adversity. What is trainable is what I do and when my guys, because I'm kind of in contact year round with Hayden Parga, my middle schooler in Reno, to Sam and, you know, and these guys. When adversity hits, I really train guys to go, hey, look, you're going to have to deal with the inevitability of these two things, success and adversity. And there's levels to each. Success could be three really good throws in practice or a Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. Adversity could be three bad throws in a practice or tearing your ACL in practice when you're lighting the league on fire as a rookie, like Deshaun did.
Yep.
So there's levels to it. But when they hit you, which is inevitable, treat them very neutrally minded. Like, this is just success. I'm going to get good at handling it. This is just a dose of adversity. I'm going to get good at handling it. And so I do think that's trainable. That mindset is trainable. So JT Daniels, who was going to light the league, the college football on fire this year, new offensive coordinator at USC, they're rolling. I think he was 9-for-11 when he tore his ACL this year, week one. This is a new dose of adversity that he's just going to have to get good at dealing with.
Right.
Mentally, emotionally, plus the physical side of it. He's got to rehab the deal. And then he's going to come back, and who knows what the situation is. So this is a trainable moment. I didn't tear his ACL, and he didn't either, right? So you got tackled weird. Stuff happens, but the moment is trainable. And so, and I think if you interviewed the guys that I've spent time with, they would point to this as saying, hey, look, thinking, helping to orient around how to think about these things. And Kyle Allen's an example of, we talked, he had to drive when he got cut from Carolina week three of practice squad. He drove 30 hours from Carolina back to Phoenix. That was an opportunity to really dive deep on this adversity, because that was a low point in his career. But he already got benched at A&M and he got benched at Houston. And those were good reps at adversity. So he had handled those well. I'm not surprised that now he has found success amidst this adversity last year and is parlaying it, because those are trainable moments. And thinking neutrally is the best way to do that. It's just, these are the facts. This is the situation. I'm not going to convince myself positively that everything's perfect and everything's awesome. And I'm also not going to dwell on the negative side. I'm going to think about it is what it is. And how am I going to handle this situation well?
So, all right. So like we've talked about like the environment, like the, sort of the nature versus nurture thing here, right? Like the environment, with that, the effect that has, those traits that you talk about, being able to deal with adversity, handle the moment on the other side of it. I talked to Joey Harrington and Brady Quinn and Tim Couch about this sort of thing last week. And I want to give you something Joey told me that I thought was interesting and see if you agree with it. Here's what he said. He said there's 50 guys in the world who can make every single throw, make every single read, can do everything necessary to be an NFL quarterback, and circumstances determine the trajectory of their career. Now, he said there are certain guys who are exempt from that, and he said, you know, Peyton Manning's probably one that's like the outlier, but most guys, the circumstances, you know, there's this group of guys who can do it, who are capable of doing it, and circumstances sort of decide where they end up 5-10 years into their NFL careers. Do you agree with that?
1,000%. And it's not just on guys making it or not. Okay. Look at my brother, right? So Carson Palmer gets drafted by the Bengals, and I'm not going to dump on anybody, but there's a lot of really smart football people. I think if you asked each of those people that you just mentioned, they'd probably all agree with this, that like, had Carson gone to one of the franchises that have really sturdy ownership and they've won Super Bowls before and they get it and know how to do it, he probably would have been the best ever, or one of them. It was, you know, it's totally right place, right time, wrong place, wrong time.
Right.
You know, Carson played for the Bengals and the Raiders. Raiders were in disarray at the time, and the Bengals hadn't won in 20 years, whatever it was. I don't know. And didn't have a bunch of champions in the ownership and the GM, and I didn't have a GM. Right.
Yep.
So, it's not a knock on the Bengals, because he had a great career there and they've gone to the playoffs a ton lately. But it's not just the difference between a guy making it or not. It's also a guy reaching his ceiling. And so you look across the board, it's totally right place, right time. I say this all the time at the draft. You can give me a guy who's supposed to go number one overall and a guy who's going to be a six round pick. And I'll make this comment every year. I'll go, look, if the guy that's supposed to be a six round pick goes to the perfect situation at the perfect time, gets an opportunity at the perfect time, right when he's ready, with the right personnel and a great play caller and the right things around him, and then the number one guy goes to the worst situation at the worst time with horrible personnel and has bad luck, the sixth rounder is going to be considered better 10 years from now. He totally is.
Right. Right.
Like you said, there's 50 guys, that number you can debate, right? More or less, whatever. Right. It's not like necessarily quantifiable. I think that's a good, accurate round number.
Yeah.
It's a good ballpark. So it really does come down to that. Like, tell me Kyle Allen has way more talent and is way better at football than Cam Newton. I don't think Kyle Allen would say that. Cam Newton has been an MVP. He was a number one pick. He's a national champion at two levels, you know, right place, right time. There's so many more elements that come into this. And I think the Hall of Fame has a handful of guys in it that were right place, right time.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. Before I let you go, I do want to hit you on the college guys, because we're a third of the way through the NFL season, halfway through the college season. I think some of this is starting to crystallize who's going to be taking quarterbacks high and also what quarterbacks are going to be going high. And so halfway through the college season, I just wonder how you'd assess the 2020 class, which is in all likelihood going to have Tua Tagovailoa in it. We'll see if Jake Fromm comes out. Obviously, Justin Herbert's another name. Jacob Eason at Washington. Just your initial impressions on that class, how that's going to break down, and how strong a class it is.
Yeah, this is a really strong class. There's a name on there you didn't even say, Joe Burrow. Another one, Jordan Love. Steven Montez out of Colorado is an interesting guy. KJ Costello from Stanford's had a ton of adversity. I've spent a lot of time with him. He can play too. This is going to be considered a top heavy class, but there's some guys that are going to go later that can play. And here's what I'll say overall, my opinion on the current state of the NFL draft as it pertains to quarterbacks, the net is getting wider and wider. The people that have talent evaluators, whether that's in the media or on the team side of things, the amount of people that they have to give an honest look at has drastically changed. It's getting wider and wider. And here's why. We got 5'10 dudes, 6-footers, winning Heismans, going number one. The all-time leading passers, 5'11". We got a kid from North Dakota State going second overall, getting a $100 million deal, and in my opinion, deserving every single penny of it. I think he's going to be an MVP multiple times in this league. We're going to have a lefty go super high next year, Tua. Like, you got all kinds of guys. I mean, Baker was a walk-on twice, deserving of the number one pick. Josh Allen, never really dominated in college at Wyoming. 7th pick. I think the Bills feel pretty good about that pick. 4-1. Like, the net is getting so much wider. When I came out in 2007, I played in the Senior Bowl with Chris Leak and Troy Smith, okay?
Yep.
Chris Leak, I don't even know if he got a workout. He might have gotten a workout with the team, but he wasn't drafted. And think about who he was at the time. National champion and, like, super prolific spread offense. Numbers were crazy, right? Mm-hmm. Troy Smith won a Heisman. You know, but he was 6'1", and Leak was 5'11", so they, like, never really got a shot, never really made it, right? Today, I think they'd be first through third round picks, both of them.
Right.
Because back then, they just weren't tall enough. But that's not the case anymore. Drew Brees is potentially the greatest quarterback that ever played. He's right on the cusp, in my opinion.
Yep.
And it's debatable, right?
Yep.
And like I said, you know, like, North Dakota State, all of a sudden, I mean, Carson's one of the best quarterbacks in the league, right? In my opinion.
Yeah.
Right. Dak's a 4th round pick out of Mississippi State, franchise quarterback for the Cowboys.
Right.
So there's just so many different types of players making it. Lamar Jackson.
Yep.
So many types of players making it that you have to evaluate everybody now. You can't just go, oh, he's under 6'3". I'm not going to evaluate his tape. Eh, he's a lefty. I don't like lefties. You better watch his tape. And, oh, he's at a small school. I don't know. Did he dominate? And so, or if he's been to 4 colleges, Gardner Minshew, I don't know. How'd he play? Is he good? Let's interview him. Bring him in for a workout. The work on the front end now, anybody can make it. And it's really cool as a guy like me who works with younger guys too. I'm sitting here going, look, there are no excuses.
Right.
If you can ball, there's a spot for you. And so this class is going to be top heavy because of the notable names. Herbert is everything you want. Tua is just so unique and dynamic and special. And the part that people haven't really got a chance to experience yet, they're only evaluating his tape and his numbers, is once the draft process hits, people will go, Tua is the guy that walks in the room and the room is different. You know, that doesn't show up on tape, but the, but you talk to people at Bama and that's a fact. Joe Burrow, you know, I saw it last year. I spent some time with him this offseason. He's an absolute franchise starter in this league. Too early to tell how high he's going to get drafted, but man, somebody's going to take him and find their franchise quarterback in him. Jacob Eason had an interesting stint at Georgia, but really reinvented himself. He's had a really good private quarterback coach named Jake Heaps, former player up in Seattle, who's really mentored and poured into him. And he's really matured in the last year and a half, but always had an enormous arm and big, talented, cool kid. Jordan Love is a really dynamic. So it's going to be top heavy, but there's some guys that I think can play later, and it's going to come down to, do they go to the right situation at the right time, and is it a good fit?
So let me ask you this then, like, playing off of what you said earlier, say Tua is in the draft 15 years ago, how high do you think he goes?
I think there's 15 years ago, there's a ton of question marks and lefty and is he tall enough? And, you know, I just think it's different. Now there's so many ways to do it. And plus, the college game translates better now than it ever has before. Mm-hmm. And when you play in that conference, they've already seen him play. He plays against an NFL defense every day in practice.
Right.
And that stuff's just more relevant. And this is the biggest piece. This is like more or less like a common question that I get. This is like the answer to a question you didn't ask, but you know, why are so many rookies playing well? Why are so many true freshmen in college playing well? That didn't used to be the case. And what's happening right now is, and it's because of social media, the high school kids have so much pressure on them from social media. And you older guys like us may go, oh, it's stupid. It's just Instagram. Yeah, but when you're 16, that's everything.
That's all you know.
Good, bad, indifferent. That's everything.
Yeah.
Right. That's your brand. There's high school kids. They have a brand. DJ Ugalecki at St. John Bosco going to Clemson next year. He's got a brand. Bryce Young at Mater Dei going to Bama. You say that name, people expect, they think something. That's a brand. Mm-hmm. These guys have so much pressure to perform. They can't go to a 7-on-7 tournament and throw four picks and play terrible because it's going to show up. It used to happen in a vacuum. Now it's happening in front of their world. And so they have so much pressure and expectations at a young age. Everything's so visible and celebrated and retweeted and reposted. So by the time they get to college, they've have real legitimate experience. And I would say Tua, yeah, he's a college quarterback, but he's dealt with a lot, like a large percentage of the things that franchise NFL quarterbacks have to deal with. He's already been dealing with that because being Tua Tagovailoa at Alabama is such a massive deal that he's just kind of more there's not going to be that much new stuff for him at the next level like there was for Josh Allen from Wyoming coming out of obscurity or Carson Wentz coming out of obscurity of North Dakota State. That's a big jump for those guys. It's just not that big of a jump for some of these dudes, for Joe Burrow at LSU, mm-hmm. for Justin Herbert, who's been talked about for 3 years now.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, like, and I even think of like, so if you want to compare it to the 2021 class potentially with guys like Trevor Lawrence and now I guess Justin Fields, you almost have to put him in that category, right? Like both those guys look like there might be teams that wait this year because they see what's coming in 2021. And so those guys are going to be dealing with a ton of pressure. Like they're already dealing with it and they've got a year and a half to go.
Yeah. I think you're going to see the leashes get shorter and shorter too.
Yeah.
It's really going to be about right place, right time, not just getting drafted high, but getting drafted high with a good play caller, the good offense and some good pieces around you and not being devastated by injuries your rookie year. It's already started. I mean, Josh Rosen, I think Josh Rosen's a great player. I think he could be great. He got 1 year in Arizona and got traded.
Yep. It's
crazy. And now he's in a really difficult situation, right?
Yep.
As difficult as I've seen, really, honestly.
2 years in a row.
And 2 years in a row, two different situations that are just really bad hands to play with. And it's not an indictment on either team. Just tough situations to play well in. And, I'd say poor kid, like, you know, that's just the really tough situation. And he couldn't do anything to control either of them. He was drafted by one team and traded to another. This is not college where he picked the wrong school.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Okay. Well, Jordan, you gave us a ton of time. I always appreciate it. I could have this conversation with you for 4 or 5 hours, but we'll wrap it up with that. He's Jordan Palmer, quarterback guru for not just guys in the NFL, but also some of the top high school kids, the top college kids, preps guys for the draft. Jordan, always appreciate the time, man.
My pleasure.
All right, and thanks to Jordan. He's always fantastic on the subject of quarterbacking. One of the guys who has these guys hands-on for the greatest amount of time, sees a lot of these kids as high schoolers, and obviously follows them as they move into their professional careers. And now it's time for our mailbag segment. You guys know how this works. We're doing it a little differently now, so I want to kind of lay out the landscape for everybody every week, at least for the time being. Two ways for you guys to get to us if you want your questions answered here on the pod. One way to do it, you can email to our email account, which is breermailbag@gmail.com. That's my last name, mailbag@gmail.com. Or we actually kind of prefer you do this. We'd love to have your voice as part of our podcast. You can leave us a voicemail. That's at 201-596-4346. Again, email us at breermailbag@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail at 201-596-4346. Now we'll bring in Shelby, my executive producer, for our mailbag question. Shelby, what do we got?
This is from Chase. With the Buffalo Bills starting 4-1 and coming off their bye week next week, In the next 4 weeks after, their opponents combined for a total record of 5-14. Do we have a reason to believe the Bills can't go 7-2 in that span?
Well, you look at it, right? So Dolphins this week, I think that it's fair to say, should be a win. Eagles the week after that, that's a little dicier. Redskins after that, I mean, that sets up for them to be 6-2 going into the Browns game, and who knows how the Browns will be playing at that point. I believe the Browns will be coming off of a Sunday night game in Foxborough against the Patriots. Look, I love where the Bills are right now. That defense has a chance, I think, over the next couple of years to evolve into a legitimate, like, multi-year strength of the team. And sort of what Sean McDermott had in Carolina with guys like Luke Kuechly and Thomas Davis, they've got foundation pieces in Ed Oliver, in Tremaine Edmonds, in Matt Milano, in Tre'Davious White. Like, you look at defensively where they're at, I really like where they're at. Offensively, they've got an identity, and how far they go, I think, is going to depend on how far the quarterback comes. And Josh Allen still has a ways to go. But they've found ways to work around some of his deficiencies as well, using him as a runner a little bit more, featuring Frank Gore in different ways. And they've got weapons around him that create easy completions for him. That was sort of the focus in the offseason in bringing in a guy like Cole Beasley. And so I love where the Bills are. I absolutely think, based on their schedule and where they're at, that they would be they look like a team that's going to be playing in January. And if you break down the schedule, I mean, let's give them the loss against the Eagles, because, again, the Eagles were my Super Bowl champion preseason. I think going into the Cleveland game at 6-2, which is early November, I think it's very realistic. And at that point, guys, you only have to go 4-4 the rest of the way to get to 10 wins. Most years, 10 wins gets you in the playoffs. Shelby, question number two.
It's from Ross. Gotta ask, as a Colts fan, is the Texans-Colts game the best / most important game of the week? Got a lot of playoff implications, and both teams took care of the Chiefs at Arrowhead.
I love that game. I love that matchup. This is sort of one of those weeks, though, where you've got a few of these. Like, if you want to talk about implications, to me, Dallas-Philadelphia, with the expectations those teams had coming into the year, is an absolutely enormous one. Because the loser of that game winds up at 3-4. And there's a good chance that one of the two NFC wildcards won't come out of that division. And so, you know, the idea of coming out of that game with a loss has got to be pretty terrifying for either of those teams. Another great matchup I just like stylistically is Baltimore and Seattle. Seattle's defense versus Lamar Jackson fascinates me because they've got speed at linebacker. Guys like Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright and Michael Kendricks, they can run with Lamar Jackson. They're not as fast as him, but they should be able to kind of they should have the best shot of maybe anybody that the Ravens have faced thus far of keeping him in the pocket and forcing them to beat him with his arm. And so I love those two matchups. New Orleans going into Chicago is interesting just because the Bears are kind of at a crossroads. But no question, Texans-Colts is up there. And for the same reasons I said earlier in the pod that I love the Niners, I love where the Colts and the Texans are right now because they've got such strength now at the lines of scrimmage. And it sounds weird to say that about Houston based on where they were 2 months ago. But really, you know, I know Titus Howard's hurt, but being able to move Howard over to right tackle, having Laremy Tunsil at left tackle, and then bringing in Max Sharping, the rookie at guard, has made all the difference in the world. They're sort of doing now what the Colts did in the offensive line last year. And so love where both of those teams are. It's a great matchup. Maybe not the best matchup of week 7, but it's definitely up there. Shelby, question number 3.
From Trevor. It seems like Aaron Rodgers is never throwing interceptions, and the only times he does, it is bouncing off of a receiver's hands. Is this a product of him being more accurate than other top QBs in the league, or is he making the decision to be less aggressive and throw less passes that could be intercepted?
Well, there's no question. I mean, you look at his numbers, and this is not just a Matt LaFleur thing. It's, you know, I mean, he's been in single digits in interceptions every year going back to the year they won the Super Bowl. The last time he had double-digit interceptions, that's 11 in 2010. And so he's always been pretty good in this area. I think playing in Matt LaFleur's offense probably helps too, and that you're doing more things in structure. Playing under Mike McCarthy, there was definitely a point where maybe his belief in the offense wasn't what it had been 3 or 4 years earlier, and he was freelancing more. I think he's at least, at the very least, giving this a shot, giving what Matt LaFleur is telling him the best chance. And so he's playing more within structure, which naturally, if you're playing more within structure, you're going to be throwing the ball into the other team's hands a little bit less. And so, absolutely, one interception through six games, is it? Yeah, one interception through six games, playing really well. And I think you're going to continue to see him get better. The last 2 weeks, I really feel like we've seen more of like vintage Aaron Rodgers, because I think he's getting more comfortable in the system. You saw it in the downfield throw for the touchdown last night. You saw it on the throw down the sideline in the Dallas game to the tight end. And you know, he's making these throws to guys who you hadn't even heard of previously. And so much so that I'm blanking on their names. So yeah, absolutely. I think Matt LaFleur is a factor, and it's sort of who Aaron's always been as well. Shelby, question number, is this four? Four.
It is. From Jason, what are your honest thoughts and expectations of this Jets team with Darnold back in the fold? Is he really capable of playing at a level where he can elevate the whole team as he did Sunday afternoon?
I think it may wind up looking that way a little bit more than is actually the truth, and that's just because of the schedule. All right, now the Jets play the Patriots on Monday night, so you assume that they're going to drop to 1-5, right? But after that, at the Jaguars, at the Dolphins, Giants at home, at the Redskins, Raiders, Bengals, Dolphins, and then they wind up playing the Ravens in December. So that's a solid 7-game stretch where it's not out of the realm of possibility to say they could win 5 games, 5 of those 7 games, right? And now you're talking about, okay, now they're a 6-win team in the middle of December. So I think there's a chance that it looks like Sam Darnold really turned things around when, you know, part of it's Darnold coming back in and playing the way that he's been playing, and part of it is the schedule. But there's no question he makes a difference. I mean, you could see that on Sunday. You could see the belief of the team in Darnold. You see the belief of the coaches in Darnold, the way that Adam Gase and Dow Loggins and all of those guys called that game. How aggressive they were in the fourth quarter when they didn't need to be. You know, at a point of the game where maybe it was time for, you know, where a lot of coaches would have said, okay, like, let's pack it in, let's run the ball, let's get the clock down, and let's get the hell out of here. I mean, they were still pushing the ball up the field. And so I don't think there's any question Sam Darnold makes a big difference, and I think there's a chance that it looks like he's making even a bigger difference because of the schedule. Question number 5, Shelby.
Hey, Albert. This is Cam from California. Calling about the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Just curious what you think they need to do. Should they bench Jameis, try someone else out? Should they try to trade for somebody? It just seems like it's, you know, more of the same with Jameis. One step forward, 2-3 steps back. So curious what you think they should be doing. Thank you.
Well, Cam, I talked earlier in the show about decision points and how the Panthers have a decision point coming on Cam. The Bucs have a decision point on Jameis coming even sooner. They got to make a decision on what they're going to do with him after the year because his contract is up this year. And so, like, I think it behooves them to stick with Jameis for the rest of the year to get as full a picture as they possibly can of who they are with him as the quarterback, who he is as a quarterback after 5 years. After 5 years, you sort of are who you are. Not to say you aren't going to get better, but if you're still having the issues that you had as a rookie after 5 years in the league, it's tough to justify going forward with the expectation that there's going to be some sort of sea change going forward. Beyond that, it's not like there's another answer on the roster. Ryan Griffin's the backup. It's not like you want to get a look at like the kid on the roster. You know, like, it's not like there's some rookie on the roster that you're looking at and saying, like, well, we got to figure out where he's at, or we got to go all in on the rookie and get him ready for 2020. There's nothing like that on the roster. So, like, I think it makes sense for the Bucs to, just from a organizational standpoint, to stick with Jameis for the time being, figure out what they have, gather as much information as they possibly can, and then make a decision after that. Because I think there's been a lot of good with Jameis. But these meltdowns, and what we saw Sunday was an absolute meltdown against the Panthers, they just, it kills you. It kills you. And again, we've seen some good from Jameis. But the idea that these are going to stop happening after 5 years is a little crazy. And so you've got, what is it, 10 games left
yep.
to figure out what you've got in Jameis Winston. if there are a couple more meltdowns like this, I think it's sort of back to the drawing board and you figure out what you can do with the position. And I mean, look, there are going to be some options out there. One of them, you know, would be drafting one. Looks like the quarterback class, as we cover with Jordan Palmer, is going to be pretty good. You know, but certainly I think at this point, like, really what you do with Jameis is you it's status quo, figure out what you've got the rest of the year, and then make a decision after that. Shelby, question number six.
From Matt, Rob Gronkowski and Antonio Brown. Do you think either, neither, or both of these guys will play this year? Gronk seems like he still wants to play, and the NFL seems in no rush to investigate the AB situation.
Gronk's a no, and I, at this point, I'd sort of be surprised if we ever see him play football again. I think when we've seen him at his realest, when we've seen him sort of at his rawest, we've seen what football's done to him. I had a moment with him like that after the Super Bowl in the locker room where I said to him, it seems like this is a relief for you to get to the end of the season. And he didn't argue with that. And you know, he said how satisfying it was to win the Super Bowl based on everything that he'd gone through that year. And he'd gone through similar stuff the year before. And I think it just took so much for him to get to the finish line that he felt lucky to get out without another concussion. He felt lucky to get out without needing a fourth back surgery, which at one point last year, it looked like he might need. And I think so much of this has been about quality of life. He's got all the money he needs. He's got three rings. He's got, I think, peace of mind now. Again, I think he feels fortunate to have made it out of the 2018 season with his well-being intact. And I don't think that, put it this way, I think the flirtations with coming back are to some degree calculated. You know, my understanding is there have been people that have told him it's good for Gronk Inc., it's good for business if you keep that door open. Because that way you stay in the news cycle, you stay in the news cycle, you're staying relevant. The more relevant you are, the more sellable you are. And so I think part of this, the idea of keeping that door open, has been a calculated business decision. And I think when we've seen him as realist, we've seen that emotion over how difficult the last couple of years were. As for Antonio Brown, look, I never seen ever with a player like this. I don't think he's going to play in the league this year, but could I see someone taking a flyer on him after this year based on just like, hey, we're going to be able to get a premium talent for almost nothing, a guy who's probably going to come in motivated. I would never rule that out. I would say, though, that it's contingent on where the investigation with the league goes and what we find out about all the alleged wrongdoings that Antonio Brown was involved in. Okay, I always appreciate you coming out, and I always want your feedback. So you guys know how you can get to me on Twitter at Albert Breer, on Facebook at Albert R. Breer, on Instagram at Albert_Breer. And we want to continue evolving this podcast. You know, we've had a lot of good guests on: Jordan Palmer, Brady Quinn, Bobby Carpenter, Dante Stallworth, to kind of break down the NFL for you. I want you guys to tell me what you want so we can continue to make this thing better for everyone. Again, on Twitter at Albert Breer, on Facebook at Albert R. Breer, on Instagram at Albert_Breer. And Shelby's going to appreciate this. My executive producer, Shelby, who came up with the idea for the mailbag the way it is. We do want your questions on here. We want your voice on here. And so if you got mailbag questions for next week at any point this week, go ahead and send them over to breermailbag@gmail.com or leave a voicemail 201-596-4346. Always remember to listen to all the MMQB NFL podcasts. We're all on one feed now. That's this podcast. That's the Monday Morning Podcast. That's the Deep Dive Podcast. That's Jenny and Connor's podcast. That's the Gambling Podcast. You can get it all on one feed now, the MMQB NFL Podcast. And also subscribe to the news podcast, which, you know, when you're driving home from work, if you want bite-sized news of the day, just kind of what's happened in the NFL, it gets you in, get you out in about 5 minutes every day. That's on a separate feed. That's the MMQB News Podcast. So there's the MMQB NFL Podcast and the MMQB News Podcast. And those are on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Same time next week. We'll see you guys then.